Thanks, Crispy, and thanks all of you for the warm welcome. Sometimes people ask, like, what it's like to give a talk at an event like this, but, you know, it's kind of like if you've read some of my books, I write them in a way that I feel like it's just, you know, two of us brewing a beer together in the backyard and having a conversation. And that's really the kind of the secret when you do like this, because you're talking to homebrewers, and, you know, the homebrewers are some of the best people in the world. So I love coming to these kind of events and talking with everyone. So I've got a book out, and it's called Modern Homebrew Recipes, and I had to submit an abstract on something, but it was before the book was written. So it's not really here to pimp the book. I really want to kind of talk about the nature of working with recipes in homebrew. So what I'm going to go through is some of the things you should know before you start getting into messing around with your own recipes, and then just how to work with them, how to take somebody else's recipe and adapt it to your system so it works for you, and then how to think about recipes of your own. And I've got a few examples at the end. So the kind of things that I think people should have an understanding of before you jump into trying to create your own recipes. You know, I do the beer judge thing, so I do kind of pound the table a little bit about on beer styles, but that's mostly just on the language of talking about beer. So if you're going to make a beer and you're going to call it something, that's really where style comes into play. It's not trying to keep you coloring within the lines. It's more that if you call a beer something, you're not confusing people. So having some knowledge of beer styles and, in general, evaluating beer really helps a lot when it comes to recipes. When you're into the business of conceptualizing what to put into a new recipe, I think it's important that you understand what the ingredients taste like, not just the flavor of the raw ingredients, but also what they taste like when they're transformed into the final product. There are things that you can do during the brewing process to affect the ingredients, affect how they wind up in the final beer. So knowing how the choice of the processes that you use changes the flavors helps you decide what processes to use. You should know how to run some basic beer math calculations, or at least how to plug the information into decent recipe software that can do the calculations for you. Because I'll talk about, you know, conceptualizing something, but then you kind of have to go and check the math to see if you really have a, you know, what kind of target you want to hit. And finally, you really should know how to brew. You know, it's, you know, some people want to jump into creating their own recipes while they're still learning how to brew, and I really don't recommend that. I think you ought to learn the fundamentals before you start going off and being crazy. I've certainly been handed a number of things from new brewers. People always want me to try their beer, and I'm always scared to death when they say, you know, they're just starting out and, like, they invented something. Yeah, I'm sure you guys get that too. When you know you're known as a beer geek, so I always kind of mildly sort of push the people back to, you know, try somebody else's recipe. You know, work on the fundamentals before you start trying to impress people. I think homebrewers ought to be building their own what I call a toolbox of techniques. I don't think everybody needs to know every single process in brewing, just what works for you, what you think you need to brew the styles that you want. So, you know, I call these personalized, not universal, in that there might be a very large list, and then you'll kind of down select based on what you actually want to accomplish. So I call it like a minimally efficient set. Like, if you learn a few techniques and you can make all the beer styles you want with it, do you really need to know other techniques if you can accomplish what you want? Because what really helps you become better at these things is the repetition, the practice, the doing something twice and getting the same outcome, even better when that same outcome is the one that you originally intended to get. So I think that it's kind of important that brewers develop their own style, the things that they want to do. Because if you're always doing something brand new, yeah, you might have some success, but there's probably always that little voice in the back of your head of wondering whether or not this is something that was a one-off, just sort of happy accident, or whether, you've got something really well done. So if it comes around to, it would be great to enter that in competition, wonder if I can do it again, or if you win something in the first round and you want to have it ready for the second round, can you, produce something of the same caliber? That sort of comes from being able to be, to execute the repeatable practices. So unless you brew all the time and can really exercise all the different processes, I recommend people start with the minimum number to do the styles they want. And some of, I covered this in the previous book, more about developing your own personal style of brewing. I hate telling people that here's the way I brew, and you should brew that way, too. That should never be the message, because so many people brew differently and produce great beer. I think it's just pompous to come across as saying, I know what's best for you. So it's all about your choices, and as long as you can make good beer with them, then, who's anybody else to tell you you're wrong? So think about your own brewing style, or, your house character in your beers. Those comes from the choices you make and the techniques you use, the ingredients you choose, how you choose to execute them, and whatever individual twists you put on those from recipe to recipe. So, here's a sample. By sample, it means things that I use. I'm not listing the entire universe of techniques, but these are the kind of things that I choose from when I build my recipes. So I don't have to use all of them, and I don't use all of them all the time, but those are ones that I seem to be using the most often. I'm not going to go through all of them because this is more about Steve.
Yeah, what's a round trip?
Yeah, that's a name I coined, so I guess I guess I should explain that one. That was a mash technique that I sort of came up with to look at getting better attenuation. So it's sort of starting at a high temperature in the mid 150s or so, setting a recirculation on it, letting it cool down to 140, and then bringing it back up. So taking continuously through the range twice. It's kind of like a step mash, a two-way step mash. You're doing it in both directions. And I feel like I owe you a dollar or something for having a segue into the next picture. It's like, what happened when I used it? That's a picture of the hydrometer reading that I got when I used that on a Saison. That's 1.002. And there's no sugar in that. So when people say that, you can't make a dry beer unless you add sugar, your pictures didn't lie. I didn't add any water to that either. So, that's the final product. So, that's just one technique I talk about in the book, but I basically told you what it was. Just slowly take it down and then back up to mash out. Round up with a very, very attenuative wort, and it didn't have a thin body to it either, because it went through some of those upper ranges. So this section I'm running through here is more of a background, because I'm going to talk about some of the recipes that I've done. So you should have a place to start. You should understand what I do, so that if you do things differently, you know how to adapt them. So normally when I brew, it's a half barrel system. If I'm doing a recipe that I want to put in a single corny keg, I'll normally make what calculates as a 6.5 gallon batch, because there'll be some waste along the way based on the kind of system I have. So if you see these oddball sized batch sizes, I'm basing the volume on the volume of wort that's going to be in the kettle at the end of the boil when I start doing something with it. So that's what I calculate my recipes on. I live in Ohio. We happen to sit on top of this huge hunk of limestone, and our water is horrible. It's full of calcium carbonate and just, I don't know, total dissolved solids is something like 450 or something. It's just nasty. So I used to spend a lot of time messing around with water. It seemed like more time messing with water than actually brewing beer. So I just go out and buy RO water. I can buy it at the grocery store for $1.90 for 5 gallons. I use a pH adjustment. I just hit it with a little bit of acid, drop it down, and then I basically don't ever have to worry about pulling tannins out in any part of the process. That was kind of a technique that I got out of working with Sierra Nevada as part of the beer camp, and I was happy to like add that technique to my toolbox. That also let me do another interesting thing, and this kind of helps in the repetition process as well. So I basically only mash the base grains, and then I'll add things that actually don't need to be mashed. You know, they're either roasted and they're crystals. They've all been converted. All you ever have to do is steep them. So I don't put them in the mash. I put them at the end. And then I basically never have to worry about all the different pH calculations that you have along the way from different grists and different waters, because my water is always the same, and what's actually in the mash is often very similar. So I just add the salts directly in the mash and mash the grains, and then add everything else when I'm recirculating and then sparging. It's kind of the same effect that you'd get if you were an extract brewer and you just steep the stuff at the start. Oftentimes I'll pick hop techniques that are designed to reduce harshness in the beers, because I have this really strong dislike for harsh beers. So I'll use a lot of first word hopping, hop bursting. I tend to avoid the hop, boil hops through the, 30 to 90 minute range. I'll dry hop occasionally, but I often use other techniques just because I'm always afraid of oxidizing things unintentionally. And I tend to use very light mineral treatments on my water just as a personal preference. So again, I'm not telling you this is how you have to do it. This is one of the things that I do. I like it this way. But it's the basis of my recipe. So when you see one of my recipes and said, well, why are you doing that? It's, because that's what I do. So I don't like to write recipes about how somebody else brews, because I don't know whether it's going to work or not. So when I give you a recipe, it'll be something that I've done. And, I can say that it works if you follow it this way. So switching gears, moving into the actual, so that's the end of the background. So looking at the nuts and bolts of how recipes are constructed, I think it's important to understand what somebody was driving for. So I think you should have a concept of the original intent when you get a recipe from somebody or read it in a book. And sometimes you want to jump in and try to brew something that somebody hands you, but I think it's really important to sort of step through the information and see, are you missing anything? Some brewers intentionally leave things out, I've got my secret ingredients. But if you find that things don't add up a certain way, it's best to figure that out before you're mashing in. So going through and trying to identify missing information. So people then ask, okay, so what do you really need? What are the elements of a recipe that you should be looking for? So the general things that you'd expect are what batch size is it for? Is it trying to hit a certain style? What kind of stats are on it? The original gravity, final gravity, alcohol, bitterness, color, that kind of thing. But also understand something about the system that the recipe was designed for. You should always see that there's a mash efficiency built in, or if somebody starts giving you volumes of liquid, there's probably an implied boil-off rate in there that might be different on your system. So see if you can figure that stuff out, because that's often different system to system. You know, then there's all the various ingredients. Sometimes the recipes will talk about water, sometimes they won't. It'll play a big part of your final beer, and I think it's kind of a crime to sort of skip over that discussion in a recipe, because it often is a big driver to a style you're making. The various process pieces, mash schedule, hop schedule, fermentation schedule, I think ought to be laid out, since the mash schedule can play a big role in what the character of the final beer is. And then finally, anything unusual that specific recipe calls for, anything that wouldn't be considered a standard technique. So those are the kinds of things that I look for. And if they're not there, I try to figure out how do I fill in those missing pieces. If you're getting a commercial recipe, or if you're looking at a historical recipe in a book, sometimes there's a lot of implied technique or implied sort of familiarity with professional brewers. They brew over and over and over again on the same system, so they don't write down the things that aren't variable. So if you're digging through old brew logs, it's often maddening because it feels like it's half a recipe, because they never wrote down the stuff that they knew how to do that never changed. So sometimes you have to infer that. But if somebody handed you a recipe and it doesn't have that information, I would say the easiest thing to do is go back to the person that gave it to you and ask, you know, can you give me these additional details? Because it kind of makes a difference when you're reworking the recipe to work on your system. Because unless you brew exactly the same way as the person that made the recipe, you're unlikely to actually reproduce the recipe as intended. So when you get that recipe and you're trying to fit it to your system, here's a list of the things that I normally want to look for to see, can I reapply this recipe? The batch size might be different than what you normally do. Like I said, I have an oddball batch size, but if you don't have that kind of waste and loss in your system, then you can retarget it. A lot of people have different mash efficiencies. They get different hop utilization rates, particularly based on the size of the system, so you want to be able to rerun those calculations. The mash schedule and techniques might be things you know how to do or don't know how to do. So perhaps you want to adjust those as well. I mentioned the rate of boil on system. I mean, most people have a pretty consistent rate when they brew, and they know if I brew for this amount of time, I'll go from this volume to this other volume. And if the source recipe you have has something different, you should be adjusting it so that you hit the final volumes, because I know a lot of people get mad if they get to the end of the boil and they don't wind up with a full keg worth of beer. Ingredients are something that people have problems with, especially hop availability with certain strains or varieties. And sometimes there are specific malts that are called out in a beer that are easy to substitute from one maltster to another, and sometimes they make a big difference. You know, if it's particularly like in a dark crystal malt, if you go from one English maltster to another, you can get an entirely different character from something of a very similar color. Sometimes when you compare American crystals against English crystals, I mean, you might even be dealing with the difference between 2-row and 6-row. So there's a different flavor profile as well. So if the flavor is different, you might want to make other changes to your recipe to account for that. Sometimes you're given an all-grain recipe and you don't brew all grain and you need to convert it. And likewise, sometimes you see a really cool recipe that's an extract recipe and you want to brew it all grain. So you might need to flip back and forth between those. But after you're done making all the various changes, you want to revalidate all your calculations so it works against your system. But you have to know how your system responds so you can plug in the default values. But I just have that reminder at the end that when you're scaling recipes or adapting recipes to a new system, some people forget that the flavor profile and the balance is kind of what really defines the style of a beer. So if you're not getting a beer that tastes the same, you might be using different ingredients. If somebody asks you, hey, I brewed this recipe of yours and I didn't really like how it turned out, ask them what they did, because oftentimes they've made so many substitutions and changes, they're making a vastly different recipe. So it's okay to substitute things, but if you change the flavor and the balance, then it's not really the same beer. So to get into doing recipes for yourself, there's just a few steps that I think people should go through in the way about going about learning, because it's not always obvious how to pick this stuff up. So the progression, I want to see people go through, or I recommend people go through, is that, start out by getting the fundamentals down. You're learning to brew somebody else's recipe. You might learn how to make variations of another person's recipe. Learn what it means, the source ingredients, what they taste like on the other end. Basically, build those fundamental skills. It's not something you can really read out of a book. It's something that you have to taste, because when you start creating your own recipes, you're going to be going on your own flavor memories when you start making changes. Because really what you're heading towards is you want to be able to start predicting outcomes. When you see something on paper, you start forming this mental image of what the final beer profile is. And that's kind of hard, because how do you actually go and learn creativity? I found this quote that I thought was awfully interesting, because I don't know that I'd ever seen somebody sort of get at the nature of innovation and creativity. And I really kind of like this, because it's being creative is connecting things. It's taking things you know how to do and applying them in new ways. There's a little bit of intuitiveness in seeing how you can use these things you know how to do something new, but it's not as daunting as some people think. You don't necessarily have to start with this blank slate. You can use these components to do something new, and then the net result is that people think it's something creative because they haven't seen it before. But if you tear it apart, you're seeing that there might be a small twist along the way, but a lot of the pieces are things that you already knew how to work with. So I really kind of like that as a quote. When I'm going about building a new recipe in the conceptualization stage, I normally start with a blank sheet of paper because I want to start writing down ideas. I've got recipe software, but I often hold off on punching these things in at first, because depending on the recipe software you're using, it might start constraining you early. If you're trying to do something new or different, recipe software often makes assumptions about what you're going to do. So I say, figure out a general direction before you punch it in, because you really should, because you need to validate it. But I hold off at first. So when you want a target, start with, are you making something that's a certain beer style? Are you inspired by a commercial example? Not necessarily to clone it, but make something that has the same general feel as a commercial beer. Are you trying to use up ingredients that you have on hand? something you might do at the end of a brewing season? Are you trying to hit a beer in a certain bitterness range or alcohol range? Are you making it for a certain occasion? Those are some of the things that might inspire you to sort of visualize the target. But you know, I'd like to start with that end in mind, because when you start adding pieces in it, you're heading towards that one goal. So the detail kind of comes from thinking of how you lay in the pieces. The graphic there is something obviously from Ray Daniels' Designing Great Beers, and that's the kind of mental image I have. I don't use his data, but it's hard because you ask somebody to describe how they think about something, they really have to stop and focus, because you often don't think about how you think. So when I tried to determine how do I describe to somebody what's in my mind when I'm picking out the different ingredients, I kind of think about this thing that Ray did, that you have a constrained list. You have, for a certain style of beer, you have this subset of ingredients that you might choose to use. And you might use them in some defined proportion. You might use them, you might not. But I tend to think about things in very much the same way. But the data that's in that kind of mental image is not based on what's in Ray's book, because Ray was just back analyzing a bunch of recipes that made it to the second round in the 90s, but more of your own experience, that if you've tasted beers and you commercial beers, for instance, and then you find out from a brewery website what kinds of grains do they use, or if you taste somebody else's beer and you discuss with them what was in there, you start thinking about those kind of choices. You're also using your knowledge of flavor profiles of ingredients to think about what could go into there. So I do kind of think about that, and I think it's kind of helpful. Homebrewers don't often do this, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong, but thinking about the grist ingredients in terms of percentages of how much is actually in a recipe, that's kind of helpful, because if you scale a recipe, then you don't have to deal with multiplying ingredients. You're just taking a percentage, and that like applies to a batch of any size. But once you're able to do that, the skill that you're getting is thinking about, for a given percentage of that ingredient in a beer, what kind of flavor contribution do they have? So it's more than just understanding the flavor profile of a single ingredient. It's in combination, how intense is that flavor and what does it contribute in an overall beer? So when you're building up a recipe, you're making these constrained choices from these bounded ranges to start putting together what you're going to use. So use your own models, use your own experience. I mean, designing great beers is a great way to get started to learn that. But the people that are doing the innovative things are the ones that are using basically their own data, not the stuff out of a book. But I think a lot of brewers think about adding the ingredients. If you sort of pin them down, I bet they would say they're thinking about something that looks very much like that. And hops are kind of similar. I mean, this is an example for grain, but when you're adding hops, you're worried about how many IBUs do they contribute. Then where you place them in the recipe, they'll give you a flavor and aroma impact. So if I'm going for a hop-forward beer, I often think about how do I maximize the hops and still not go over my sort of IBU budget. And that often drives where I place hops in a recipe. So I think you have to think about both of those together, and that it's also driven by the technique. So, trying to think again how you would use that model. I tend to start with the for grains. I tend to think of what gives you the largest flavor impact, which might not be the same thing as what is the largest by weight. So, you know, start with the things that add the biggest flavors first. So in a darker beer, that might be one of the dark malts that's giving you a major flavor. So if you use, if you start with laying those in first, then sometimes the other ingredients don't matter as much. Like in a dark beer, you'll lay in those kind of flavors, and then usually it's just, and the remainder is base malt. So I tend to start with like what drives the flavor first. Continuing in the range of specifying, I might list grain generically. I might say I can use two row here, or if I'm looking for a very specific flavor, I'll start getting into the variety of grain or even the maltster. If I want a very bready flavor, you know, it would be like Maris Otter. If I want a Maris Otter that responds a certain way, I'll put in like crisp Maris Otter. If I don't want something so bready, you know, maybe I'll go with Golden Promise. So you do think about the flavor contributions, because not every maltster is going to be producing a grain that's called the same thing, that tastes the same way. So that's where experience comes in with using not only the repeatable processes, but the repeatable ingredients. I kind of advise against buying just any grain on the market. You know, if you get something you like, keep buying them again because you know what they taste like. And if you use something new, consider that a test batch, because you're saying, am I going to wind up with something that tastes like what I want, or is that particular malt taste like something different? So after you've made these choices, that's the point where I tend to validate in software to make sure that the numbers all work. And then the final step would be, you know, since I'm going from percentages to weights, I'll often like do a little rounding just so that it winds up being something easy to measure or easy to buy. This ties to the creativity slide. How do you apply that building something creative out of things you know? It's one of those things that I call like the Tinker Toy method. If you're familiar with that, like you build up these little pieces, then you build bigger things out of these little systems that you have. So the kind of things that are equivalent to Tinker Toys in a recipe, for me at least, are coming up with base grain combinations. For instance, if I'm making a pale American beer, one of the things I like is 45% Pilsner malt, 45% two row, 10% Munich. I mean, you'll see something like that in a lot of my recipes, just because I've used it, I know what it tastes like, and I like it. I used to have another combination that I would use that was half Maris Otter and half Vienna, you know, some unusual mix. That was kind of one of my malty blends. But if you have a successful recipe that you like, you know, think about not the recipe as a whole, but is there a piece of the recipe that you can grab out and say, yeah, I really like how that works, and I could use that in other places in new styles. Specialty grain combinations, like maybe you like how chocolate malt goes with a carafa, or don't use black malt in combination with roasted barley. You know, there could be these combinations, either positive or negative, things that you want to include or things you don't want to include. But if you've got a combination, particularly if you're looking at the relative percentages, then those are things that you can reuse when you build new recipes. Hop combinations is kind of something that people talk about a lot. Like Amarillo and Simcoe go really well together. Cascade and Centennial go really well together. If you find some collection of hops that work, you know, consider that a reusable component that you can use in new recipes. Yeast is something that a lot of people just grab whatever's available in the shop, but you know, I think there's something to be said for using a small set of yeasts over and over again so you can understand what happens when you throw different fermentation conditions at it. You know, yeast is fine when it works, but if it doesn't work, some people are perplexed and start panicking and doing really you know, unusual things. Well, let's add nutrients. Let's add, you know, other yeast. Let's, you know, make it really hot. Let's, you know, they're basically just thrashing. So if you've used a yeast and know how it responds, you can also know how to work with it, that, you know, things you should or shouldn't do to it because you have an understanding of what kind of fermentation byproducts it'll kick off depending on how you treat it. So I recommend that people start with like a small number of yeasts for different kind of families of beer. Have a good American strain, a good English strain, a good Belgian strain. You know, start a good lager strain and kind of start from there before branching out. So the key point of that is you're really trying to use these sort of proven methods and proven combinations in new situations. You're building something new through something familiar. So it feels like you're not walking the tightrope quite as much because even when you're experimenting, there's that element of familiarity there. The creative aspect of brewing, again, is this notion of balance. And a lot of people confuse what balance really means, whether it's balancing, balance kind of implies things of equal weight or things of equal intensity, but balance is really relative to the beer style you're making because, you know, a balanced barley wine is a lot different than a balanced Helles. You know, balanced IPA is different than a balanced porter. So balance is really what makes something taste good for whatever style you're doing. IBUs and original gravity are important, but they don't tell the whole story. I think Ray came up with a good thing in designing great beers with the BU to GU ratio. That works if your beers of similar strength and similar attenuation, but it doesn't work so well if you're comparing vastly different beers. Because if you forget about attenuation and final gravity, that can really drive the final character of a beer. The example I like to use is how a lot of American craft brewers make triples. They kind of start out like they're making a barley wine, and they say, well, I'll just use this really attenuative yeast. And then it finishes at 10-18, and they wonder why it tastes wrong. It attenuated, 80% or 85%. Why does this taste bad? Well, because it's too sweet. The final gravity is too high. Well, how do I get it lower? Well, start lower. Start lower, get the same attenuation, finish lower. Because remember that hydrometer reading, dry, is a low final gravity. So if that's what you're looking for, start low to finish low. Some people also confuse the what sweetness means. The flavor of malt versus the flavor of sugar, malty versus sweet, or the measure of body, the kind of dextrins in a beer that you feel as a in the mouthfeel, and whether that's the same as sweet. Because dextrins aren't sweet; they're longer chains, they're starches, and they don't really register as sweet on the palate. They just register as this sort of heavier feel. But a lot of people kind of confuse that. There's also the notion of how bitter is your beer really. There's the measure of IBU, and that's an estimate of what most people are working with. There's lab measures for it, but there's kind of more to it than that because you're just measuring the concentration of a certain chemical that comes from hops, but other things can make a beer bitter. And some of those lab methods don't really work as well in some of the modern hop techniques, especially ones that are using a lot of, really late hops. Those can misrepresent the IBUs in a beer. So when you're estimating IBUs, you also have to balance that against what your palate tells you at the end, because you know, it's not the numbers that you're concerned with balancing. It's how the beer presents on your palate. When people are doing creative new things with a beer, something they need to keep in mind is what components balance what other components. Like Saison's a good example because bitterness can balance the malt that's in it, or you can make sort of a one that's got some sourness to it, and then sourness basically does the same thing that bitterness does. So you could have like a Saison that has some acidity in it, but you better drop the IBUs because those two things are piling on each other to balance the same malt. So that works in a number of ways. Alcohol can often work that way if it's adding a sharpness. So keep in mind these palate impacts and watch out for using if you're adding something to a beer that winds up creating a clashing flavor. So I got a couple of examples, practical, of how I applied these techniques in building some of the new recipes. So I got three recipes that I wanted to talk about and how I went about putting them together. And all of these are in the book in more of a full detail. Okay. So there's this modern Oktoberfest style. It's one of the new styles in the guideline. It's basically how Germans make Oktoberfest now. So the way I started was I looked at the target specs I wanted to hit based on commercial products, and then knew that I wanted to have it mostly based on Pilsner malt because the idea was that it still needed to be drinkable. So trying to keep it from being too Bock-like was my goal, because the classic Märzen-style Oktoberfest often reads that way. So I had a Helles recipe and a Maybach recipe that I used to sort of bound where I wanted to place the Oktoberfest. So I looked at putting the Pils malt somewhere in between there, because I wanted it to be richer than a Helles, but not quite as Bock-like as a Maybach. And I also consider like Munich and Aromatic to be hitting in you know, to somewhat extent, Vienna, sort of in the same place. So I wanted to, fit those character malts in there in the same way. Scaling the recipe to the size and gravity you want. Here I was more concerned about finishing dry, because the drinkability in German lagers really comes from a decent finishing gravity, that German lagers tend to be malty, not sweet, so you want them to be dry in the finish so that they're drinkable, not sippable. So starting there is what then led me to a target gravity to hit the alcohol range that most of those commercial examples had. So then when I was selecting yeast and techniques, I wanted to avoid things that would make it taste too much like a Bock. Normally in malty beers, I'd like using the White Labs 833, which is the Eyinger yeast. It makes things taste kind of malty and Bock-like. So I went with sort of another classic yeast that's malty, but not quite so intensely malty. The balancing of the IBUs kind of in the same way. I didn't want something to... He loves when I do that. looking for the hops not to be over the top. And I was using a step mash instead of a decoction mash because that can play up the maltiness. So in putting together this kind of recipe, so what I was trying to do is kind of use other known recipes as a bound and then adjust it by some of the things I was trying to accomplish. Again, I'm working in percentages here in the book. It's written up in detail. Another example I had was creating something kind of experimental, something I called like a spring IPA. So I start with trying to describe what is it I'm trying to do, and that was like trying to fuse a Maibach with an American IPA. So giving it malty but dry, but cranking up the bitterness and the late hops. So this is kind of interesting because it's kind of taking something like the Maibach recipe from the previous page and then adjusting the parameters so that it's at a much higher bitterness level. And then using mostly German hops, but with a little twist in there, a little Centennial and Nelson to give it some interesting character. And then selecting hop techniques that like make the hops come out, something that you really wouldn't expect out of a German lager. So that was another choice of a recipe where I started with basically an IPA recipe and a Maibach recipe and started pulling components from it, looking for this kind of balance that hit this concept that I was able to start sketching out at the start. Finally, there was like one when I did kind of scaling up a recipe I liked to produce, another recipe I liked. So, taking sort of a known IPA recipe and doing a double IPA out of it. So the thing to look at there is more how the gravities and the alcohol sort of went up and the hopping went up. So changing some of the bitterness balance of the beer. But if you look at the classes of grain here, if you consider like pils and two-row and pale as sort of some of the base malts there, and then seeing how that calculates against the two-row and the double IPA recipe, it's about the same. I've got some Munich in one and Munich in Golden Promise. There's one where I'm doing a combination of malts, honey in one, honey and sugar in another. Same kind of idea. They're in the same fermentable class. So it's keeping something with sort of a similar balance of groups of ingredients the same, while making little twists to make it not seem exactly the same. And then just changing the balance somewhat and then selecting hops to give it that different feel. So I did kind of get the hook. I think we have about 10 minutes left. If anybody wants to ask any questions, I'd be happy to hear them. Thanks for staying with me on this.
Gordon, when you move your roasted grains into the Vorloff process versus mm-hmm. putting them in the mash, was that done more for a water thing, or did it actually change the flavor profile of those specialty grains? And so if I take my existing recipes and try to do that, am I going to have to adjust those percentages of roasted malt?
I did it for, that's a good question. It's something I get fairly often. I did it for flavor impact. I did it to remove harshness because sometimes when there's a lot of roasted grains and they wind up being mashed, you get roast out of it. But if you try adding them at the end, you get a similar flavor, but it's kind of smoother. The analogy I use is like fresh coffee versus coffee that's been sitting on the burner for an hour. You actually get a noticeable flavor difference. So the reason was flavor, but they're related to these other aspects of the recipe, so that caused me to have to adjust water. What I then realized, if I did that across this whole family of recipes, that I could use the same approach regardless of what style. Once I pulled the dark grains and the crystals out, a lot of the reasons for messing around with the water profile for the mash went away. So that's what gave me the repeatability there. But then if I want to do something that's style specific, if there's like an English IPA or something and I want it to have more of a sulfate character, I'll just put that in the boil. Because you want that flavor to come through. But really about when you're in the mash, all you're looking for is to like hit a good pH with enough calcium there, so you get like a nice conversion. But once you're done with that, you know, you don't really need other brewing salts to drive that.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. It was wonderful. Could you go back to the last slide and talk a little bit more about the grist changes that you made, why there's pills in the single IPA but nothing, no pills in the double IPA? Could you have changed the malt backbone a different way in the double IPA?
Yeah. I'd have to check my notes when I actually did it, but what I would expect is that, like, I was out of pills at the time, so I decided to see what else I could do. Because you notice, you know, I made some other changes. I'm, like, adding a little bit more Vienna. You know, I'm not using pills, which has a certain flavor, so I added some other things that also have flavor. So instead of, you know, 38% pills, I added 11% Vienna and then gave it some, you know, gave it some golden promise. So, you know, I'm still looking for some additional flavor contributions, not just a very neutral two-row. So, but, yeah, I mean, to be honest, you know, I just could have been, like, out of pills at the time and, you know, went with what I had. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, this is where you can make those kind of substitutions if you understand the flavor impacts of the ingredients you're using.
Thank you for your presentation. How long do you Vorloff with the crystals to extract the sugars?
So I'm doing it as part of, like, going to mash out. So it's usually about 15 minutes. So
yeah. Thank you.
I want something clear, and that's just about how long it takes to get up to about 168. And then I'll sparge. So obviously they'll still be in there. So if it's another 15 minutes or so, you know, it might be in total contact like a half an hour, which is very similar to what you would have done if you were an extract brewer and just, you know, dunking it.
On step mashing versus single infusion, with the well-modified malts that we're working with, what advantage do you feel that you would get with step mashing?
That's another good question. So there's a difference between converting starches to sugars and getting a certain profile of the sugars that you get, because you know, conversion doesn't just lead to one type of sugar and you're done. So yes, they convert, but you know, I'm also looking at fermentability and dextrin. So often I use a step mash, like a German technique, that that, you know, I'll have a rest around 131 for a short amount of time, because if I have a lot of pills, because I find it gives me a little bit better clarity. Then I'll have a rest in the mid-140s for fermentability. Then I'll hit it at about 158 to give it some body.
So you're getting different sugars at each?
Yes, sugars and dextrins. So the question was, how long does it take for my system to go between steps? I have a half barrel, three vessel system with a, you know, each is direct fired. It's a Pico system, and it kind of depends on how fast I hit the flame on it. You know, it ramps a couple of degrees a minute. Typically, I have a pump, so when I'm doing this, I'm pulling from underneath. It's kind of like a poor man's rims. It's pulling from underneath a false bottom where the heat is being applied and adding it on top so that the same wort isn't always getting heated. So the question is, like, what do I count as the time in a step? It's the time when I've actually landed at that temperature. So, you know, I try to get to it in a reasonable amount of time. But, yeah, I'm usually measuring that. When I'm talking about mash out, I often include the time of ramping. Because really what I'm looking for at the end is just, you know, that it's clear and it's ready to run into the kettle. The fact that I hit that temperature is what's important, not that I'm like holding it at that temperature. You ask a lot of questions for somebody that's not near a microphone. But go ahead. You had one more. So the question is, do I circulate or not throughout the entire mesh? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It depends on how much I'm going to change it. I tend to not circulate during the mesh just because I want to be able to go back and stir it a few times. And I don't want to be stirring it while I'm recirculating because I can set the bed that way because I have to stop and start. But if I'm stepping, you know, I'll let it sit for 10 or 15 minutes before I start ramping it again.
I had a quick question or two about pH, and you said that you use acid to acidify your sparge water and also to set your pH of your mash. What acid do you like to use, and why did you choose to do acid over, say, an acidulated malt to be able to achieve that pH?
That's a good question, too. Acidulated malt is fine. You know, it's a traditional German method. I used acid because it seems more direct to me. And I tend to use 10% phosphoric. I think Northern Brewer sells it over, you know, other people do as well. I originally picked that because it's the most flavor neutral of the acids. So if I ever, you know, missed in some direction, I wouldn't want to carry over the flavor from lactic, for instance. But, you know, in the concentrations we're talking about, I'm sure it would be fine. And I kind of like using sort of the more dilute acids because it's kind of easier to measure. You know, you don't have to use the as precise an instrument to get there. It doesn't take very much to knock. I mean, once I figured out about how much it took, I measured it in volume. So, you know, it wound up being sort of like a quarter teaspoon per 5 gallons would be enough to knock it down for me. So really, when I get RO water, all I do, rather than measuring pH throughout, is I just use a TDS, a total dissolved solids, to, you know, hit the source water. And if it reads near zero, I know the rest of the process is good to go. I don't have to keep continually monitoring it because it's repeatable, and I have measured it, and I know it's consistent. So then, you know, more time for drinking, less time for measuring.
Thanks.
And on that note, I'm going to say we're done here. We have to get out. Thank you very much, Gordon.
Thank you.